This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article for this week's episode is from NPR, and it's entitled Between Tariffs and Survival, American Business Owners Are Doing Alarming Math. Many U.S. shop owners feel like collateral damage in President Trump's trade war, on the hook to pay big new fees and long unable to manufacture in the U.S. Many American shop owners are feeling like collateral damage in the global trade war. Sarah Wells ponders how her 13-year-old business, selling breast pump backpacks and other items to new moms, will run under President Trump's new tariffs on all imports. Just this year alone, her company, Sarah Wells Bags, has shouldered the cost of two rounds of tariffs, which took effect right as Wells' shipment from China was en route. Her large order was loading at the port in February when the White House raised tariffs on Chinese imports by 10%, and by the time it docked stateside in March, tariffs had gone up again by another 10%. Wells had to shell out an unexpected $15,000 to release her goods from customs. Now, with the latest round sending total tariffs on Chinese imports to 54%, eating her profit margin, Wells is reeling. She may have to raise prices, but how much before shoppers rebel and stop buying? She plans to retrench, order less, pause hiring, and stop developing new products. Even if we pass some cost to the consumer, we can't pass it all, says Wells, based in Virginia. So I really think the honest answer is that businesses will close. For some, it's survival mode, which means shrinking selections and freezing hiring. How much or how quickly shoppers might pull back is not clear. The National Retail Federation had forecast retail sales to grow this year, slower than in recent years, though more likely than they did before the pandemic, between 2.7 and 3.7%. But the forecast was released before the magnitude of new tariffs became clear, spanning the globe ranging from 10% to over 50%. And now the trade group says it's impossible to predict the magnitude of change on prices and on consumer behavior. Giants like Walmart, for example, are now pressuring their foreign suppliers for discounts to offset some of the tariffs. Smaller retailers don't have that kind of muscle. In surveys, retailers across the board warn that they're going to have to raise prices. And then there's the scale back. Like Wells, many business owners are thinking of pulling back, perhaps shrink the store's selection so there's less to ship, freeze hiring, pause advertising, or developing new products, stop growing and go into survival mode. What is the need to have versus the nice to have? I think right off the bat that's where it will start, says Jessica Bedencourt, who runs Clem's General Store in Massachusetts. Founded by her grandfather 75 years ago, Clem sells a wide range of products, including hardware, pet food, and clothes. U.S. made can mean 3 to 4 times the cost. One key argument President Trump makes in favor of tariffs is that they would jumpstart American manufacturing, forcing more companies to source their products domestically. Wells, Bedencourt, and many others say they've tried. U.S. manufacturers couldn't tackle the scale of Wells' orders, she says, when she looked into making or at least assembling her backpacks and purses here. Plus, those manufacturers told her the raw material would have to come from China anyway. South Carolina business owner Rosalind Goodwin ran into a similar challenge. We have, for the last 8 years, been trying to manufacture in the U.S., says Goodwin. She and her daughter sell double-snap hair barrettes called Gabby Bows. Every manufacturer in the United States we have spoken to has told us, you need to continue making this in China. It's going to cost you 3 to 4 times more to make it here. Our customers will not pay $8 to $10 more for this product, Goodwin says. The case of $400 work boots. For many common items, clothes, shoes, toys, electronics, the U.S. has not manufactured them at scale in ages, if ever. Smaller scale operations are much costlier, often double or triple the price of overseas options, and typically require imported supplies anyway, as Wells has discovered. Betancourt says, consider work boots. Her store does carry American-made boots, and they're $400 a pair. Imported alternatives often sell for half that amount. Not everyone can afford to buy a $400 pair of work boots, she says. So I do want to always look at that U.S.-made product first, but I also have to offer my customers what they can afford. As another shopkeeper put it, small business owners like to make their own decisions and feel like they can live and die by them. The sweeping blanket tariffs are taking that ability out of their control. Our next story comes from Business Insider, and the title is Wharton Business School Overhauls Curriculum Around AI. The nation's oldest business school is evolving for the new AI-powered world. The University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School has unveiled a new MBA major and undergraduate concentration in artificial intelligence. It will be available to students in the fall of 2025 as one of 21 MBA majors, alongside options like accounting, finance, marketing, and real estate. For undergraduates who earn a degree in economics, it will be one of 19 concentrations. The new curriculum will help students develop both a technical understanding of how businesses are using AI and a more conceptual sense of the technology's economic, social, and ethical implications. Students will be required to take classes in machine learning and ethics and choose from a list of electives spanning data mining to marketing to neuroscience. One of the required courses will be Big Data, Big Responsibilities Toward Accountable Artificial Intelligence, an ethics class. Foundations of Deep Learning will be a new class in the Statistics and Data Sciences department, giving students an introduction to the technical foundations of AI, Wharton Professor Giles Hooker, an advisor for the new AI curriculum, told Business Insider by email. It will cover the technology underpinning the AI boom, including topics from what is a neural network and how to train it, to generative AI, to efficient deep learning to ensure students have a solid conceptual grasp on what goes on under the hood in modern AI models, according to the syllabus. Wharton also updated the syllabi for existing classes, including the management course Innovation, Change, and Entrepreneurship, and the marketing course Introduction to Brain Science for Business. In a university press release announcing the changes, Eric Bradlow, the Vice Dean of AI and Analytics at Wharton, said, "We are at a critical turning point where practical AI knowledge is urgently needed. Companies are struggling to recruit talent with the necessary AI skills. Students are eager to deepen their understanding of the subject and gain hands-on experience. And our faculty's expertise on the adoption and human impact of AI is unmatched," he said. At the intersection of AI and business, Wharton faculty began discussing a new AI curriculum last year, Hooker told BI. In May 2024, Wharton launched the AI and Analytics Initiative to study possible changes to its curriculum, invest in new research, collaborate more with industries, and create open-source generative AI resources, according to Penn Today, the university's official news site. Through the initiative, Wharton has launched the AI Research Fund to help faculty pursue research at the intersection of AI and business, and the Education Innovation Fund to help faculty adopt AI in the classroom. The initiative was also to provide ChatGPT enterprise licenses to all full-time and executive MBA students starting in the fall of 2024, a first-of-its-kind collaboration between a business school and OpenAI. In January, Wharton unveiled the Accountable AI Lab, which will produce research on AI governance, regulation, and ethics, with a practical focus on business applications. Wharton, therefore, had several building blocks in place for a new curriculum, Hooker told BI. A lot of what we had to do was work on how to structure a useful and coherent path through what we offered and then see if there was anything we really needed to add. Students who graduate with an AI focus will ideally be adept in four areas, Hooker said. They'll have a strong technical knowledge of AI to assess the design and application of AI models in a business and be informed enough to keep up with new AI developments. They'll have a sense of how AI will impact business operations. They'll also have a handle on the ethics of data and automated decision-making and understand the legal frameworks governing AI. Companies these days are hiring candidates who specialize in just one of these areas. For example, a company might hire an AI researcher to train an LLM model, a learning and development expert to teach teams how to use the technology, or a lawyer who understands data privacy and regulations. But graduates of Wharton's new program may emerge as jack-of-all AI trades. Their skill sets will be tailored to a future workplace where adaptability might be more valuable than specialization. We expect the impact of AI on businesses to be long and deep. Even without new breakthroughs in human-like reasoning, we can expect AI methods to penetrate even further into business processes and our lives, Hooker said. The careers and job titles associated with its penetration into business haven't yet been fixed. Continuing with content from Business Insider, our next article is entitled, "I Took the Federal Buyout, Kept My Six-Figure Salary Through September." It was a quiet Tuesday in January, until it wasn't. I was working from home when my phone started blowing up thanks to the latest headline from the new administration, a buyout offer for all federal employees. Friends and family instantly started reaching out. Are you taking it? Should you? My federal career as an economist started under the same president, but under completely different circumstances. When I joined the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, in September of 2018, it was pre-COVID-19, pre-reckoning with the remote work, and pre-Trump's second term. I'd spent a year applying to jobs while working as an admin at a hospital, so landing an economist role felt like my first real break. Back then, Washington, D.C. was filled with young professionals like me, eager to serve in the government. We took the metro alongside other federal employees, went to happy hours with policy wonks, and took pride in our work. A pandemic, 4 years of Biden, and Trump's return had changed everything. The Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, was up and running. Buyouts, forced reductions, and agency closures were suddenly on the table. Finally, I got an email. The email outlined the deferred resignation program, which allowed employees to resign voluntarily while receiving full pay and benefits through September 30th. We had until February 6th to decide, and the instructions were, 1, hit reply from your government email, 2, type the word resign, 3, hit send. That was it, a one-word email, and my federal career would be over if I wanted it to be. Many of my colleagues and I were suspicious. Elon Musk promoted the offer on X. Meanwhile, unions and Democratic senators urged us to stay put, warning that the administration wouldn't honor the deal. Reddit, particularly the federal employee subreddit, became ground zero for debate. Historically, a quiet forum for things like promotion strategies or TSP investments, it became a frantic speculation hub. Some people urged caution. Hold the line, they said. I had to make a decision. I'd enjoyed my time in the federal government, but it was clear that this would no longer be the same job I'd signed up for. More information filtered in. OPM, the federal government's HR agency, shared FAQs through some of the language felt eye-roll worthy, like the lines about how we could take the vacation of a lifetime. Debates about productivity also emerged, with some commentators suggesting we move to the private sector, where higher productivity awaited. Helping to produce labor statistics that guide economic policy seemed productive to me, but not everyone saw it that way. I dove deep into federal policy for information, and I learned about the Anti-Deficiency Act, which prevents agencies from spending more than Congress allocates. Some argued this meant the buyout couldn't be real. If the government hadn't budgeted for it, how could they pay us? I read about the 1990s buyouts under Bill Clinton, $25,000 lump sum packages that were legal and straightforward. This new program was framed as administrative leave. Were they structuring it this way to make their offer more enticing but not violate the law? Doubts lingered. OPM kept sending us updated version of the forms with slight tweaks, vague language, and looming deadlines. If the offer were valid, I'd continue receiving my full salary of $130,000 through September 30th without working and with active benefits and pension contributions. For someone with a few years of service and no plans to retire soon, it was a rare window to get paid to plan my next move. I hit reply and typed resign. On the last day the program was open, I sent the email. A few hours later, a court in Boston issued a pause on the program following a union lawsuit, leaving it in legal limbo. The program remained open but under review. I didn't stress about it. I was still working, closing out revisions to the year's employment figures. For 6 years, I worked through shutdowns and elections and pandemics, and this was no different. Evidently, the court ruled that the buyout was cleared to proceed. Another round of HR forms came in. A signed contract from my department clarified key things like I'd not be expected to work past February 28th and would continue to accrue annual leave and be paid for it out at the end. Meanwhile, mass firings began across the government. Probationary employees were laid off in droves and agencies were gutted. I thought back to my first year in D.C., fresh out of college and new to the city from New Jersey. How devastating would it have been to relocate for a job and get cut in your first year? I didn't see myself as a casualty. I had made my choice. As I entered my last week of work, I felt thankful. My supervisor was understanding and supportive. He acknowledged how much I'd be missed, but supported me in doing what was best for me. I appreciated the lessons, the well wishes, and my supervisor's juggling of our busy work period, a resignation, and other new rules and regulations. I am on a brand, and oddly comforting way, my last day was unceremonious. A performance review, a UPS drop-off for my government-issued laptop, and that was it. Whatever happens next, this chapter is closed. I've done a lot of working out, reading, and applying for jobs. I hope to start a new job soon to avoid an extended loss of income. If I start a new job, I would still get paid as long as it doesn't violate ethics rules, which is unlikely to be a major consideration for my position. While I apply, I have some travel lined up. Later this month, I'm heading to Manila, Bangkok, and Sydney. Our next article is entitled Mortgage Rates Hit a Six-Month Low Amid Tariffs, But It Won't Revive Housing. The 30-year mortgage rate dropped to its lowest point since October amid the week's trade war chaos. This may not last long if tariff revenue revives reflation, pushing rates back up. Tariffs could also weaken buyer sentiment and raise new home costs by as much as $9,200. President Trump's latest tariff salvo has wreaked havoc on markets, but there may be a silver lining for home buyers: falling borrowing costs. Mortgage rates fell to a six-month low on Friday, lowering one of the biggest barriers for U.S. housing shoppers. According to data from Mortgage News Daily, the 30-year fixed rate dropped from 6.75% to 6.55% between Wednesday and Friday, hitting the lowest level since October. Trump's harsher-than-expected tariffs prompted investors to seek refuge among safe-haven Treasury bonds this week, driving yields down. Mortgage rates closely track long-dated bond yields. As it stands, the benchmark 10-year Treasury yield dropped below 4% for the first time since October on Friday, helping to ease. The respite will be brief, however. Initially, this should seem like welcome news for buyers navigating a historically unaffordable housing market. Elevated rates have kept current homeowners from selling, reducing market inventory and boosting home prices. In 2025, this is translated into a housing cool down, with transaction activity slowing to a crawl. It's logical to expect falling rates to revive demand, but to some analysts, this could be a short-lived window. That's if tariffs disrupt supply chains and boost inflation, which would prompt interest rates and consequently bond yields to stay up. Mortgage rates are going down at the moment. However, when the higher cost of goods start to push up the inflation rate, it's quite possible that rates will go back up. I expect to be on a mortgage rate roller coaster for the next few months, Melissa Cohn, regional vice president of William Ravey's Mortgage, said. That's because tariffs could raise inflation and keep expectations for interest rates high, in turn keeping bond yields high. The push and pull between inflation forecast and growth fears could keep bond yields stuck in a narrow range, keeping a floor under mortgage rates. The trade war is a hazard for home buyers. Though purchase applications jumped to their highest levels in nearly 2 months just ahead of the tariff announcement, analysts suggest the trade war could exacerbate market headwinds. Recent duties are expected to increase the average cost of a home by $9,200, according to the latest National Association of Home Builders survey. An estimated 7.3% of goods required in residential construction were imported into the U.S. in 2024. At the same time, tariffs may pull back consumer appetite, keeping buyers out of the market. Home price growth would cool moderately, and Goldman revised its full-year appreciation outlook down to 3.2%. First, the labor market will likely cool, and our U.S. economists recently raised their base case forecast for year-end unemployment rate to 4.5 versus 4.0 to start the year. In an environment of high debt-to-income ratio on new origination, a marginal drop in employment or income growth could materially weigh on demand, the analyst wrote. Our next article comes from Fast Company magazine, and it's entitled Six Steps to Negotiate a High Salary Even in a Tough Job Market. It's hard out there, but that doesn't mean you still can't get paid what you're worth. Here's exactly how to do it. It's no secret. Landing a job in today's economy can feel overwhelmingly difficult. Qualified candidates regularly apply to hundreds, sometimes even thousands of positions before receiving that one coveted offer. In fact, over half of unemployed job seekers have been searching for 4 months or longer, highlighting how competitive the market has become. And it's not just the job market itself that's challenging. We're living through one of the most turbulent periods in modern history. For example, the U.S. unemployment rose to 4.1%, the highest in over 2 years. 23,000 tech layoffs occurred in the first 3 months of 2025 alone. Nearly 50% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. And consumer debt hit an all-time high of $18.04 trillion, with credit card delinquencies increasing sharply. University degrees are no longer a guarantee of success. Even government jobs, once considered safe, are under threat. It's no wonder many job seekers feel anxious or fearful about asking for more. Negotiation expert and career coach Ted Leonhardt notes that the fear of asking for higher pay has always been an obstacle. And in today's volatile environment, that fear can feel even more paralyzing. But he emphasizes workers at any level are more vulnerable today than at any time in memory, perhaps since the Great Depression. This makes knowing your worth and advocating for yourself all the more essential. Here are six essential tips for confidently negotiating your salary in today's tough economy. First, hide your desperation. A Pew Research Center survey found that most U.S. workers did not ask for higher pay the last time they were hired, with men slightly more likely than women to negotiate. Even if you're surviving on ramen and desperately need the job, don't let it show. Employers often interpret eagerness as desperation, leading to lower initial offers. Take your time to respond, usually 24 to 48 hours, and subtly indicate you're considering multiple opportunities. This helps maintain your negotiating power. Leonhardt further advises, always be developing a new opportunity for yourself. A side gig, a better job elsewhere, having other options in progress or appearing to can drastically reduce that sense of desperation. Second, know your worth and back it up with data. Before negotiating, gather salary benchmarks from sites like Glassdoor and PayScale and LinkedIn Salary. Present clear, data-backed reasons for your requested salary based on your experience, skills, and current market rates. Leonhardt succinctly puts it, know your value and use it as leverage. Leverage is always your superpower. Staying true to your worth can provide dividends. Annie Papp, executive vice president at Career Group Companies, advises that in any job market, applicants should be prepared to come right out and ask for a raise or negotiate higher compensation. While it may seem obvious, most people don't like to do this, assuming their employer will offer a raise without prompting, which is rarely the case. Third, quantify your value. Make a detailed list of your accomplishments and quantify your impact whenever possible. For example, increased sales by 300% within a year, or manage projects that increase revenue by X amount. Even before the negotiation, review this to remind yourself of your accomplishments and the value you were bringing to the table. This will boost your confidence. 4. Bet on yourself and plan for the future. If the job offer isn't quite what you want it to be, focus on creating a clear path to get there over the next year. Jason Giagrandi, the CEO of Hospitality Farm, suggests bet on yourself. Propose a lucrative bonus structure with aggressive milestones or KPIs that your boss would be happy to pay if accomplished. Everyone wins, and it will motivate your growth individually as well as help your company grow. Not only does this show initiative, but it also aligns with your compensation with company goals, making it easier for employers to say yes. 5. Be willing to walk away, if you truly are. One key to negotiation success is the willingness to walk away. Listen carefully, remain composed, and always take the time to consider the offer before responding. And 6, consider negotiating benefits, not just salary. If salary negotiations stall, consider other forms of compensation. Diversify your request to reach a deal that satisfies both sides. Signing bonuses, professional development funds, flexible work arrangements, or extra vacation days can all hold significant value. This market is different because employers are being more cautious when it comes to hiring and budgeting. A few years ago, on the heels of the pandemic, applicants could negotiate higher salaries much more easily because every employer was in a desperate race to retain talent. Now that's not the case. The frenzy has slowed and employers are taking their time. While inflated salary increases may no longer be the norm, advocating for growth is still crucial. Losing strong talent can ultimately have a far greater cost than providing a reasonable raise, Papp says. If higher compensation isn't immediately feasible, ask for a timeline to revisit the conversation. Finally, Leonhardt offers a lasting piece of advice. Always be developing your connections and community, both online and off. Connections with those you help are always the best opportunity for your continuously evolving future. Negotiations can feel intimidating, especially in a fragile, uncertain world. But by advocating for yourself thoughtfully and strategically, you're not just setting yourself up for immediate success, you're safeguarding your long-term career stability. Continuing with another selection from Fast Company, our next article is entitled, What's Behind the Rise in Interim CEOs? High turnover in the C-suite and the changing needs of businesses are leading to more temps in the top job. Interim leadership is on the rise in the U.S. Nearly a quarter of new CEOs named in the first 2 months of 2025 were hired on an interim basis versus 8% in the same period last year, according to a recent report from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. The surge in interim leadership coincides with significant tumult in the C-suite. The Challenger report shows that 247 U.S. companies named new CEOs in February, the second highest total for any month since the firm started tracking CEO changes in 2002. A lot of times when a company brings in an interim CEO, it's when they've been caught off guard by the CEO's departure, says Andy Challenger, senior vice president of the outplacement firm. It's not a part of a structured succession plan. An interim CEO can buy a board time to conduct a thorough search for the right executive, especially if it feels the company needs skills that the existing leadership team lacks. Management experts say they are also seeing companies, particularly mid-market and investor-backed businesses, hire temporary CEOs during changes such as restructuring, merger integration, or executing a new strategy. Their expertise can be crucial to navigating complex changes that require seasoned leadership. Even temporary solutions can be transformative for an organization, says Sonny Ackerman, global managing partner of the on-demand talent at Hendrick & Struggles, the executive search firm. The temp to perm CEO. Interim roles also can serve as a tryout for prospective CEO candidates and companies can engage an interim executive while they figure out what they need in a leader. Ackerman recalls working with her team on an early-stage medical technology company that sought to replace its founder with a full-time CEO. Hendrick and Struggles brought in a life sciences consultant who had been a CEO to create a plan for market entry. The board then hired that consultant as interim CEO to execute the plan. Once they saw his operational skills and market expertise in practice, the board eventually decided to convert him to permanent CEO. Other temp-to-perm CEOs include Chipotle's Scott Boatwright, who went from an interim in August 2024 to permanent status 3 months later, and Lance Tucker, who last month was named CEO of the Jack in the Box after a 36-day stint as interim CEO of the restaurant company. Avoid leadership limbo. Companies need to be careful not to let interim leadership linger. If an interim is placed too long, it may communicate the wrong message to the market and employees and create uncertainty about the future leadership of the organization and its strategy, says Janice Ellig, CEO of the executive search firm Ellig Group. Employees and the market like certainty. They want to know who is at the helm and what direction they are headed. And in the absence of clear guidance from the board, some interim chiefs may act like caretakers instead of leaders, causing the company to lose ground during the search for a permanent CEO. One thing's for sure, interim CEOs aren't going away. Ackerman notes that many of the CEOs exiting businesses right now are baby boomer and Gen X retirees who are eager to remain active by taking on interim roles, generating a larger pool of independent talent than we've ever seen before, she says. Are you a temp to perm leader? Are you a CEO or a leader who turned a temporary or interim role into a permanent one? How did you win that role? Be sure to send us your stories, and I'd love to share your experience in a future newsletter. Our next article comes from Fortune magazine, and the title is Boss Uses a Recruiter-Approved Coffee Cup Test in Every Interview, and He Won't Hire Anyone Who Fails It. There's another red flag test to have on your radar, this time involving coffee cups. One boss says he won't hire anyone who fails it, and recruiters tell Fortune it actually works. Previously, we've heard from a CEO who rejects job candidates who say they can start right away, and the sneaky salt and pepper test that plagues lunch interviews. Now there's a coffee cup test to add to job seekers' list of hoops they need to jump through to land a job in today's tough market. The trick was described by an Australian boss, Trent Ennis, who is the former managing director of accounting platform Zeno and now works as the chief growth officer at SiteMinder. Speaking on the business podcast The Ventures, Ennis said that he always takes prospective employees for a walk to the kitchen for a beverage, and although he calls it a coffee cup test, it's not about whether you take your caffeine hit black or with sugar. You could even forego coffee for water or tea and still pass the test. It's what you do with your cup afterwards that he's keeping an eye on. Then we take that back, have our interview, and one of the things I'm always looking for at the end of the interview is, does the person doing the interview want to take that empty cup back to the kitchen? Unfortunately, those who have the right skills for the job but leave their dirty mug at the scene of the interview probably won't hear back from the hiring manager. Ennis thinks it's a red flag and they're not the right culture fit for the company. You can develop skills, you can gain knowledge and experience, but it really does come down to attitude. And the attitude that we talk a lot about is the concept of wash your coffee cup, the boss added. Taking your used cup, mug, or glass back to the kitchen highlights that you're a team player, considerate, and care about the small things. CEOs at Cisco, Amazon, and Kurt Greger echo the importance of attitude. It's not what you know or even who you know. Countless CEOs have highlighted that success hinges on attitude. Like Ennis, Andy Jassy has said that an embarrassing amount of how well you do, particularly in your 20s, depends on it. I think people would be surprised how infrequently people have great attitudes, the Amazon CEO revealed. I think it makes a big difference. Likewise, the CEO of Pret and Kurt Geiger have both stressed that being nice to their boss and coworkers is one of the biggest determining factors in their success. You cannot teach positive attitudes and engagement and energy, Cisco's UK CEO Sarah Walker echoed recently in Fortune. That's the number one green flag trait she keeps an eye out for when hiring or looking to promote from within. She said it outweighs what's on your resume, especially early in your career. It's more about the person first and foremost than it is about the skills or experience. Recruiters say the test actually works. If you want to test for attitude over aptitude, you'd be happy to learn that the coffee cup test actually works. Louis Mallet, CEO of the global executive recruitment agency Bentley Lewis, says that it's one of the many subtle tests he's seen in his 20 years of recruiting experience, and I think there's some real value to it. I've found that these little behavioral observations can tell you so much about a person that you'd never catch in a formal Q&A, he says, adding that employers could also watch how interviewees treat reception staff or similar intel. So much of hiring is about culture and fit, and I think this is an important part of assessing whether someone would suit your organization. But he wouldn't pin the entire hiring decisions on such tests. I see it more as one piece, he adds. Go for it, but keep it in perspective. Not every great candidate will think so clearly in their cup, especially if they're nervous or unfamiliar with your office. Some might even come from work cultures where this wasn't expected. After offering to help an assistant clean up coffee cups people had left behind from a prior meeting, Saria Dermer says she landed a role at SF Recruitment. In the 4 years since, she's been promoted to CEO. It was between me and another candidate, Demmer recalls. I insisted on helping, and she fed back to the two MDs making the decision that she strongly felt I was the better fit for that reason. I don't personally put people through this test, but I do think it's a good one because it's a real live test of EQ, teamwork, and understanding of the environment around you. These skills are crucial to success and a very good guide as to how likely someone is to have a positive impact on others or not. Culture is such a huge driver of business success that I would applaud any leader who takes the level of care to consistently look for those kind of details. Continuing with content from Fortune magazine, our next article is entitled Warren Buffett Keeps Taking Investors to School as Stock Meltdown Reveals the Uncanny Wisdom of His Recent Moves. The stock market crash triggered by President Donald Trump's global tariffs brought Warren Buffett's investment moves over the past year into a fresh light, underscoring his prudence amid the once-raging bull market. His decision last year to shed most of Berkshire Hathaway's Apple stock now looks especially well-timed. Berkshire Hathaway chairman and CEO Warren Buffett's investment moves over the past year now seem uncannily well-timed in the wake of the stock market meltdown caused by President Trump's global tariffs. In the last two trading sessions alone, the S&P crashed 10%, and the broad market index is down 17% from its mid-February peak. Meanwhile, the tech-heavy NASDAQ and the small-cap Russell 2000 are in bear market territory, having tumbled more than 20% from their recent highs. Since Trump's Liberation Day announcement on Wednesday, U.S. stocks have lost more than $6 trillion in market cap in the worst sell-off since the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. But Buffett appeared to anticipate a market downturn coming. Berkshire sold $134 billion of equities in 2024, when the bull market was still raging and was sitting on a record $334 billion of cash pile at the year end. That's nearly double from a year earlier and more than its shrinking stock portfolio of $272 billion. The famously value-oriented investor has also been complaining for years that valuations were too high and has held off on using his cash on major acquisitions due to a lack of bargains. Most of Berkshire's cash in the short term, treasury bills, which will not only offer shelter from the storm but also provide the conglomerate a tidy gain that Buffett noted in his most recent letter to shareholders. We were aided by a predictable large gain in investment income as T-bills yield improved, and we've substantially increased our holdings of these highly liquid short-term securities, he wrote in February. In addition to what he bought, he sold also stands out, giving the market crash. Last year, Berkshire slashed its Apple stake by about two-thirds, representing the bulk of the company's equity sales, though the iPhone maker remains its largest stock holding. Those stock sales, which came in the first three quarters of the year, also occurred while Apple was still on the rise, with shares peaking in late December. But since that peak, Apple has collapsed 28% as U.S. tariffs on China are expected to hit especially hard. That's because Apple, like many tech companies, relies on China for parts and manufacturing. With Trump's latest round of tariffs, imports from China now face a 54% duty, and the administration follows through on its threat to impose a secondary tariff on countries that buy oil from Venezuela. That rate could hit 79%. Meanwhile, Berkshire has also been offloading shares of Bank of America and Citigroup. Shares of both banking giants are down about 22% so far this year. By contrast, Berkshire's Class B shares are up 9% this year, though they have taken a modest hit this past week. The wide array of its businesses, such as insurance, rail, and energy, are mostly focused on the U.S. and less exposed to imports. As a result, Buffett's personal fortune has grown this year, unlike those of his peers. According to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, his net worth has expanded by $12.7 billion this year to give him a total of $155 billion, putting him at number six on the list and essentially tying him with Bill Gates, whose own fortune shrank by $3.38 billion. Elon Musk remains number one with $302 billion, though that's down by $130 billion in 2025, followed by Jeff Bezos, down by $45.2 billion. As Buffett watchers wait to see if the recent market crash will finally induce him to make a big acquisition or stock purchase, his February letter may offer a clue. Berkshire shareholders can rest assured that we will forever deploy a substantial majority of their money in equities, mostly American equities, although many of these will have international operations of significance, he wrote. Berkshire will never prefer ownership of cash equivalent assets over the ownership of good businesses, whether controlled or only partially owned. And sticking with fortune, our next article is Walmart CEO says paying its star managers upwards of $620,000 yearly empowers them to feel like owners. For many employees, it can be hard to feel connected to their company, especially at huge corporations like Walmart. But in 2024, U.S. CEO John Furner pulled out the big guns to ensure star managers feel the love by paying them upwards of $620,000 a year. What we did last year was make managers feel like owners, Furner said recently at a retail and consumer conference. This includes shareholding, which has positively impacted their approach to the company's profits and losses. In a bold move to boost morale and retention after fighting turnover and manager shortages during the pandemic, the $689 billion retail giant gave its top-performing regional store managers a serious payday in January, raising their total compensation to between $420,000 and $620,000. Their average base pay was hiked from $130,000 to $160,000, with the rest of the roughly $500,000 salary made up of hefty stock grants and annual bonuses. This is the largest wage investment in our people, Walmart spokesperson Ann Hatfield told Fortune. This has been a years-long journey with increases in hourly pay that started in 2015. With more than 4,000 store managers across the U.S. and about 1.6 million workers in total, the payout isn't just generous, it's a calculated bet on culture. And that bet is working. In 2024, Walmart claimed the top spot on the Fortune 500 and landed on Fortune's Best Companies to Work For list, not just last year, but again in 2025. With a 1.6 million strong workforce, it's not easy to keep everyone happy. But Walmart went straight to the source, cold hard cash. Pay raises are essential for employee satisfaction and retention. Bosses may sling around promises of unlimited PTO and swanky office amenities, but it's more about money than most workers really want. About 73% of workers would consider leaving their employer for a higher paycheck, according to a 2024 report from Bamboo HR. Money talks, yet 40% of employees haven't received a pay bump in the last year. Salary deflation and a slowdown of pay raises have been driving staffers up the wall. As grocery prices continue to soar and the cost of living crisis persists, many would be swayed by more money now than ever. The cost of getting compensation wrong is easily realized in multiples later, said Kelsey Tarp, director of HR Business Partners at Bamboo HR. When employers need to go to market for talent, they might find the salary ranges to be inadequate to attract the talent that is needed. There is wage compression to address, and all of which will be more costly in the long run. The employer's paying up to boost company culture. Some employers have already caught on. When Cameo wanted workers back in their Chicago headquarters, the company offered up to $10,000 bonuses for going into the offices 4 days a week, rather than showing the mandate in their face. After Rolls-Royce pulled an extraordinary business turnaround in recent years, it handed out nearly $39 million in shares to employees. It wanted to pay its successes forward by rewarding the people that made it happen. Each staffer got 150 company shares each, worth a little over $900 in total. We want to recognize your contribution to our future success and reward you for the role you will play in it, CEO said in the internal memo to employees. Even when companies are hitting the wall, they turn to pay hikes as a Hail Mary to try and turn things around. When thousands of Volkswagen employees in Germany were striking over pay cuts and factory closures, the car manufacturer had offered its Tennessee plant workers a 14% pay raise over 4 years. After Exxon employees faced a tough era of salary freezes, 401k match suspension, and intense layoffs, the oil giant changed its tune. On average, workers received a pay hike of 9% above inflationary levels, with some top performers who got promoted seeing raises between 15 and 25%. Our company performance reflects the hard work, commitment, and perseverance of our employees, Exxon spokeswoman Amy Von Walter said. We take great pride in the exceptional business results that our teams delivered, despite it being a time of uncertainty and significant change. Moving on now to Forbes magazine with an article entitled Time Management at Work: Efficiency Should Be Rewarded, Not Punished. Most time management advice assumes people waste time because they lack discipline or need a better calendar. But many employees aren't inefficient because they don't know how to manage time. They're stuck in a system designed to reward presence over progress. In some cases, expectations are set to match the pace of the slowest worker. Early in my career, I worked in sales where the standard was to make 5 client calls per day. Some days I easily exceeded that number. When I asked what to do after finishing early, they literally told me to slow down. The company's priority was making sure everyone filled an 8-hour day, even if there was only 1 hour of actual work. The rest became about busy work meant to look like productivity. This is a widespread issue. A Microsoft study found that employees spend 57% of their time communicating in meetings, emails, or chats, and only 43% doing what they were actually hired to do. No wonder people feel overworked yet underproductive. Time management has become focused on fitting more into the day. But it shouldn't be more focused on clearing the clutter that shows people down. That could mean fewer meetings, shorter email threads, or less duplication of effort. It may also mean rethinking approval processes or allowing people more control over how they work. David Allen, the author of Getting Things Done, told me in our interview that the brain is a poor office. It wasn't built to manage priorities, remember dozens of to-dos, or track projects. That's why so many people feel overwhelmed, even with relatively short task lists. He recommends capturing everything externally, organizing it into manageable pieces, and revisiting it regularly. Kevin Cruz, author of 15 Secrets Successful People Know About Time Management, The Productivity Habits of 7 Billionaires, shared with me how he focuses on how intentional behavior drives time efficiency. His research shows that top performers aren't faster, they're more focused. They create time blocks, work toward specific outcomes, and ignore low-value tasks. For them, engagement means more than just being happy. It means caring enough to give discretionary effort, the kind that leads to real results. One way to improve time management is to use artificial intelligence to streamline repetitive tasks. Tools like ChatGPT and meeting summarizers can take on the time-consuming work that distracts from high-value contributions. AI can draft emails, summarize long meetings, organize research, and even generate content ideas. These tools allow people to spend more time on creativity, strategic planning, and collaboration. Used well, AI frees up energy that would otherwise be spent on low-impact work. David Allen pointed out that freeing the mind from clutter is critical for focus. AI can support that process if people are curious enough to try it. A simple experiment like asking AI to sort priorities or write a draft can lead to huge gains in productivity. In many workplaces, efficiency is punished instead of rewarded. The person who finishes early and leaves on time may be perceived as less committed than the one who lingers after hours. But equating time spent with value created is a flawed model. Employees shouldn't have to pace themselves artificially to match slower colleagues. Companies need to rethink the idea that work must fill a specific number of hours. Instead, outcomes should matter more than activity. When expectations are shaped around output rather than time served, it encourages autonomy and innovation. This doesn't mean pushing people to work harder. It means creating room for those who want to work differently. Some employers and employees have maybe content to meet the baseline. Others may want to move faster, take on more, or use technology to do things better. Recognizing and rewarding that effort benefits the entire organization. Time management is really shaped by company culture. When people are rewarded for busyness, they'll stay busy. But if organizations emphasize effectiveness and results, employees will shift their approach. It starts with acknowledging that not everyone works at the same pace. It continues with training and tools to help employees manage their attention and time. And it works best in an environment where curiosity and experimentation are encouraged. Kevin Cruz said that culture is built on growth, recognition, and trust. Leaders who build those three elements into their system give people room to thrive. Time efficiency is just one outcome of the mindset. To create a workplace that values time efficiency, leaders and teams can start with small, intentional shifts. Here are a few actionable steps. Replace face time expectations with output-based performance reviews. Train managers to recognize results rather than hours logged. Encourage time blocking or focus hours for deep work. Streamline meetings by requiring agendas and limiting attendees. And create space for experimentation with new tools and workflows. By integrating these changes, companies send a clear message that time is valuable and how it's used matters more than how it's spent. As demands increase and resources stay tight, organizations must do more with less. That doesn't mean pushing everyone to the edge. It means reducing waste, encouraging autonomy, and empowering people to use their time well. For many professionals, they don't mind working hard as long as it's rewarded, and they just want to stop wasting time. That begins by removing the pressure to match the lowest common denominator of worker, the slowest pace, and designing systems that support high performance, not just long hours. To obtain better time management, it is important to recognize that it is shared responsibility that includes focusing on culture, curiosity, and the courage to challenge old assumptions. And our final article for this episode comes from Inc. magazine entitled, "Main Street Employers Are Still Struggling to Fill Job Openings." A National Federation of Independent Businesses survey found that the number of small companies still having trouble finding suitable job candidates increased in March. Government employment data released on Thursday reflected an extended trend of companies balancing relatively few layoffs with equally modest new hire rates. But small businesses are facing another form of labor market tension created by an entirely different reason, according to a Thursday report from the National Federation of Independent Businesses. It blamed low hiring rates among Main Street entrepreneurs on their difficulties finding suitable candidates for openings they need to fill. That shortage of ready, willing, and able prospective employees that NFIB members complained of in February became more pronounced last month. The organization's March poll found 47% of small business owners reported few or no qualified applicants for the positions they were trying to fill, which was up 2 points from the previous month. Among companies that sought to hire for openings available last month, 87% said that they'd failed to find appropriate candidates. Included in that group were 26% of entrepreneurs who lamented that few suitable people applied for vacancies, and 21% who said that nobody did. With qualified workers in short supply, job openings stayed solid on Main Street in March, NFIB chief economist Bill Duckelberg said in comments accompanying the findings. As spring progresses, fewer small business owners plan to create new positions, but they're looking to fill current openings. That largely jives with wider national trends, though for different reasons. Yesterday's Labor Department data showed that the number of applications for unemployment benefits had dropped slightly, prolonging the relatively stable job market conditions that emerged in late 2024. That labor tension has increased since then, as employers became increasingly wary of potential economic slowdowns from the Trump administration's economic policies, notably sweeping import tariffs, and have adopted cautious staffing strategies in response.